Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Parenting Aces radio show on Blog Talk Radio's UR Tennis Network. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and we have another great show for you today. We're going to be talking Division III tennis, high performance, junior development, and kind of all things in between. And I have a great guest for you today. He is actually the coach at Case Western Reserve University. His name is Todd Watkowski, and he's got some incredible experience to share with us today. I want to encourage you guys that have high school age players to really pay close attention, and if you have questions, please call in. Our call-in number, as always, is 714-583-6853. Again, that's 714-583-6853. If you're listening to this as a podcast, unfortunately, you won't be able to call in, but I hope you enjoy the information and will share it with your tennis friends. As always, our show does get podcast not only on Blog Talk Radio's UR Tennis Network, but also on ParentingAces.com and the Parenting Aces channel on YouTube as well as iTunes. So there's lots of ways you can listen on your phone, on your iPod, on your computer, and we hope that you'll help spread the word about the UR Tennis Network and, in particular, Parenting Aces. And that you'll share the show with your friends. Also, I want to remind you that the show does air live for 60 minutes. At the end of the 60 minutes, if we're still going, it will go into podcast recording mode, at which point you'll have to listen to one of the podcast outlets to hear the very end. So stick with us. I hope you enjoy today's show. Before I bring Todd on the line, I want to play a quick commercial, and then we'll be back with today's guest, Coach Todd Watkowski.
Warning. Orthopedic surgeons are seeing an increase in overuse injuries when young athletes perform the same repetitive stressful motions over and over. Pitching, tennis, weight training, even long swimming workouts can cause overuse trauma that may require surgery. If your kids play and train hard, visit orthoinfo.org or stopsportsinjuries.org. A message from the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons and the American Orthopedic Society for Sports Medicine.
Welcome back to Parenting Aces. I'm your host, and I am pleased to bring on the air today's guest, Coach Todd Watkowski from Case Western Reserve University. Todd, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks a lot for having me. I'm excited to talk tennis.
I'm excited to talk tennis. So let me give our listeners a little bit of background on you. You are currently the head coach at Case Western Reserve. Do you coach the men and the women still, or just the men at this point?
I'm entering my seventh year at Case. My first 5 years, I was head men's and women's. And in the sixth year, last year, we were able to get funding to hire a full-time coach. So we named a head men's and a head women's. And Kirsten Gambrell is our women's coach who played her college tennis at DePaul in Chicago.
Awesome. And you also were the assistant at the Citadel for a while and played tennis yourself at Ohio State. And you've coached kind of at all levels, right?
Correct. I like to think that there isn't anyone out there that's put on as many hats as I have, because out of high school I went to University of Toledo and played there, got a lot better. I worked out, I stayed there in the summers, I did a lot of extra work with Coach Al Wormer, and happened to get my game up to a level that I felt I could compete at that next tier of schools, that sort of BCS level. So I transferred and talked to Ty about going to Ohio State and ended up transferring there, finishing my career at Ohio State. Went from Ohio State to coaching at a Division I mid-major. And then when I finished my MBA at Citadel, I jumped into Division III men's tennis. So I've kind of had a play in each part. And then finally, now, as part of coaching at Case, I'm running a high-performance junior group at a local racquet club. And so, again, just diversifying how many different ways I have my foot in the game. So,
do you sleep?
It's funny. We have our junior program has 5:45 a.m. clinics, and it has 7:30 p.m. clinics. So I'm in the office pretty much during the day and doing things at Case. And in the early morning and at late at night, I work with the juniors. So I do get some sleep, but a lot of the guys on the team often joke about how I can keep going at the rate I go without sleeping as much. But I think that the key here and the parallel that would be drawn to kids thinking about playing college tennis is I've found my passion, and I've found something that I am truly, truly obsessed with. And to me, it's much more fun than sleeping. I love talking about it. I love doing it. I love coaching. So, you know, it's a blast for me. And so when kids are looking at playing college tennis and looking for their experience, then a lot of times you have some programs that are super, super into it and love it, and some that are a little bit more like having the experience there to go along with their academics, but maybe not as serious. So, you know, it just depends on where you think you fit. And I've been lucky to have some players on my team that are almost as obsessed with it as I am.
That's fantastic. Well, talk a little bit about main differences that you've seen from both the player and the coaching perspective between Division I tennis and Division III tennis.
Sure. The Division I experiences that I had at University of Toledo and at Ohio State were certainly more hours on court and more serious than they are at the Division III level. And much of that is due to one rule. And the rule is that the coaches at the Division III level are not permitted on the court with their players outside of the 19-week NCAA season. So you have 19 weeks to work with the Division III that you can be on the court with your players, and that is it. And that's not even half of a year that you're with your players. At Division I level, however, they're able to be with their players on the court throughout the year. Except, you know, I don't quote me on this, but I think the Ivy Leagues might have some sort of a little bit of a different rule themselves. But generally in Division I, players can go on the court with their coaches throughout the year. And that's a huge difference in the amount of hours that player can be training under supervision and under guidance. So, you know, to me, some might say that the biggest difference is some, you know, Division I you get scholarships, Division III you don't. To me, there are a lot of Division I programs that don't have scholarship. It's more about how much time you get to spend on the court with your coach. And if you're not going to get to spend that amount of time, it's really more about you as a person. How driven are you? How motivated are you to find ways to get yourself on the court to get better during that off time?
Right. And even at Division I, there is a limit to the number of hours that the coach can work with the players. So, the players still have to find that outside motivation to work. And, you know, that's a big difference in college tennis today versus, you know, 20, 25 years ago. There weren't those limits. So just kind of an interesting thing to keep in mind. We have a caller on the line. Let me just see if they have a question or if they're just listening. caller from area code 913226. Are you there? Do you have a question for us? Okay, maybe they're just listening to the show. Great. So, okay, Todd, so when you say that you're limited to working with the players only during the NCAA season, which is in the spring, correct?
Well, typically what the men's tennis programs will do is they'll, at Division III, is they'll go about 6 to 7 or 8 weeks in the fall, and then they'll use the remainder of their 13, 14, 12 weeks in the spring semester. So predominantly it does become the spring semester entirely, and the fall will be about the first half.
Okay. And but I mean, during those training periods that you, the coach, are actually on court with your players, I mean, the practices, I would assume, look like a college tennis practice anywhere, Division 1, 2, or 3. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, I can't speak for other programs. I don't know what they're doing. You will, in the recruiting process, as you're a high school athlete, do visits to programs. And you'll find that different coaches have different styles. Now, I do try to model my practices as much as I can, similar to what we did at Ohio State. And, you know, it's not a very complicated thing. It's very simple. It's just a lot of disciplined practice, simple concepts that you're working on over and over and over again. And we do ours in the morning. So oftentimes we'll practice at either 6 or 7 in the morning, and we'll get everything in before the school day starts. Now, if you're a student that's ambitious and you're ahead of your schoolwork and you're doing well, we offer a second practice later in the day, which would be an opportunity for a player to work on more individual things rather than, you know, team-based practice. It's the same idea as, you know, you're like, you had a son that played tennis and I'm sure took clinics and private lessons, right?
Right.
So, you know, we try to make it, you know, a little bit seamless from juniors to make sure that they're getting that group-based play, but they're also getting the individual attention later on in the afternoon. And that's, you know, typically the way that we do it. It's been pretty funny. We practice, you know, like I said, at about 7 in the morning, and we're surrounded by apartment buildings and houses that are all kind of in the area. And the sorority that's next door to our tennis courts, the president of that sorority used to actually date one of the players on our team, or still does date a player that was on our team. And they would... They would joke all the time about how they'd much rather hear, like, jackhammers and construction outside their window than the tennis team out there at 7 in the morning making noise and causing ruckus, because we keep our energy level very, very high during our practices. So it, you know, it becomes a fun environment. It gets them awake. It gets them going. And I've found over the years that, I mean, our guys that have graduated and have gone on to work and have to be in at work at 7 or 8 in the morning have found that, you know, they have no problem with that. I mean, they're adjusting well to life after college tennis, and they have their whole day to do their work. But I would, you know, I would definitely ask these questions if you're a junior. And, you know, as you mentioned, you know, I work with high school kids, you know, that are in the area that are pursuing college tennis. I have them come back from visits to schools and tell me, you know, kind of about what they're seeing and what's going on. And I can't believe how different. I mean, it's like every single program does things, you know, a little different way. Some leave it more open to the kids to get their hits in on the weekend, and some are running practice Saturday and Sunday and giving them maybe Monday off of, you know, of practice.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, you know, one of the kind of preconceived notions I had about Division III tennis was, you know, if you're highly academic and you're really focused on your studies, that going to a Division III school is the way to go because you're going to get that high-end academic environment and you're going to get to play tennis on the side, and it's just kind of kicks and giggles on the tennis court. But as I've gotten more involved in the college tennis world through my own kids' recruiting, I'm learning that you know, my preconceived notion was pretty off base. I mean, yes, the academic challenge is there in the Division III programs, but it can also be there in Division I and Division II, and that high-intensity tennis world can also be present in Division III programs, not just in, you know, the top-level D1 programs. So I think what you said before about going on the visits, you know, that just becomes such a crucial piece of the whole recruiting process. And I mean, we've learned so much by visiting the different campuses, you know, just in the last couple years with my son. And every program, like you said, is different. Every coach is different. The environment at the school is different. And so I want to encourage the listeners that if you have a high school student that's aspiring to play in college, really explore the various types of programs out there. Because not all D1 programs are created equal. Not all D2 programs, not all D3 programs are created equal. They each have unique facets to them that you can only really find out by talking to the coach, talking to the players, and spending some time around them.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, one of the things that I love the most, that I remember the most about when I was at Ohio State was Ohio State, football's pretty big, and the Saturdays kind of get overwhelmed with, you know, if there's a home game. Let's say, for example, even, you know, Ohio State's playing Michigan at home on a Saturday. It didn't make any difference to the way we kind of went about our training. I mean, we still got up that morning and got our hit in, and we would finish practicing. And I remember driving, you know, from the facility back to the house and just seeing everybody kind of filing in for the football games and thinking to myself, like, how good I felt about myself that I got up and I got myself going and I did something with my day, you know, comparatively to what the other students were doing on campus. You know, it just kind of made me feel good, feel better about getting up and getting yourself going. You know, and you visit, and maybe other schools aren't the same. Maybe, you know, oh, it's a home football game, and maybe they just don't hit that day, and they kind of take that day off, and you know, it can be totally different. But that was one of the greatest feelings I remember, is always getting up and getting in our workouts before, you know, most of the people were getting their days going. And you know, just kind of increased the confidence level of our guys. And the other thing that the parallel I can draw there is these kids are playing these USTA tournaments over the summer, and you know, your son has too, right? So how often has he played 8 a.m. matches?
More often than I would like.
Right. Well, more often than anyone would like, right? Well,
yeah.
you tell me, if your kid's in a summer program and they go to clinics in the summer and their average wake-up time is maybe 8 a.m. and they're on the court at 9, well, then what leads you to believe that when they go to that tournament, that level one or whatever it is, and they're scheduled for an 8 a.m. match, what are the chances that they're going to perform at their best in that 8 a.m. match if they're not used to actually being up and performing at that time?
That's a great point.
So, you know, I think it's, for us, so many times we have to be up performing early in the morning, like the Clay Court Invitational. I was watching it in the office at 8 a.m., and the commentators on there, I think Tribley was one of them, he was saying, well, a lot of times with these 8 a.m. matches, it's just more of, you know, who's alert and who's awake. And I kind of chuckle to myself, well, if it's a kid that's in our junior program or if it's a kid that's on my men's team here at Case, that's something that we can control. That's a variable of the match that we can have control over. Well, we better control that and make sure that we're prepared and we're not beating ourselves before we even walk out on the court.
That's a great point. I can't believe the commentator actually said that. That's interesting. And a sad statement, really, on what some coaches maybe are doing to get the kids prepared for these early morning tournament matches. Wow.
Well, it's just one of those things that you don't ever think of. Like, you know, you probably, until I said that, you may not have actually thought, okay, has my son been waking up at 6:30 on the weekdays in the summer? Is he used to being up at 6:30 because he has an 8 a.m. match? Right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, no, we actually do have that conversation at our house, but I hear what you're saying, and you're right. And it seems like such a basic component of competition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and preparing for competition, that of course you're going to work that component and make sure that you have that under control.
I think another point, Lisa, is, see, like we talk about this a lot of time as a team. If we can control, if you have two players or two teams that are pretty evenly matched and they're competing against each other, then usually the win or the loss is going to come down to some smaller variable. Something like, oh, that player is better indoors, or, you know, that player is better at handling like windy conditions, or, you know, maybe that player is a better clay court player than the other, or, oh, well, there was a confrontation at 4-all in the third, and one of the players made a tight call. So from that point on, it's not really the quality of tennis played. It's really more who handles the mental challenge better from that point on. Because you have some players that will completely fold and some that will continue to play their best tennis post that confrontation.
Right.
And you got to try to control these little variables. So you've been researching college tennis and you've been kind of seeing the changes that are going on. And the one change that I think has been really evident in the last 10 years has been the energy and passion level during the matches. These things are far from quiet. I mean, there's a lot of cheering. There's a lot of energy. There's a lot of support to your teammates. And what I've found is there are teams that go out there and they practice, and then when it comes to the weekend and they have to play a match, then that's when they decide, okay, let's start pumping it up. Let's start cheering. Well, you know, it takes a lot of energy out of your body, like a lot of energy, to win a point that maybe lasts 20 shots, and then to turn around and yell across six courts to pump your team up.
Right.
It's a little extra energy, but it's good for entertainment and it's great for the product, and I think it's awesome. So when we're at practice, even if it's 6 or 7 in the morning, we put a huge, huge value on cheering and supporting each other so that when it comes time to go into the match, you're used to it. You know how it works. Like, you know how to maintain that energy level.
I love that. It's funny because that's actually one of the things that has attracted my son to some particular programs is exactly
really?
What you're talking
nice.
About. Yes. He nice. That's what he wants out of a college tennis program. And it's one of the questions he asks when he speaks with the coaches and with the players. He asks about, you know, what's the team kind of environment or culture around cheering, and you know, does that happen during practice or only during matches, and you know, how do y'all work on that? And it's been an interesting thing for me to see, because I never thought that was really his personality, that he would care about that. So, you know, as our kids go through this recruiting process, we learn things about them that we didn't know maybe, and it's pretty cool from the parent side too.
Well, I'm glad you have that perspective. There's some people who still think things should be quiet, you know. But I think if you went to a high-intensity match, and to be honest with you, it could be, you know, USC versus UCLA, or it could be Case Western versus Carnegie Mellon. You know, it really doesn't matter which level you're at. The quality of play, when there's that much energy and passion and interest and you've got fans surrounding the courts and there's a lot of screaming and yelling, it's just more exciting. And I, you know, personally, I think it's great for our sport because it just provides a lot more energy. I mean, for lack of a better word. And, you know, it makes the product more entertaining. And so that's good. I mean, because that is an important thing, is how teams are training and how they kind of, what kind of energy level they play with. And that's a key thing you're looking at when you're watching the teams practice, when you're doing that visit, is how are they you know, how are they practicing? Are they getting the most out of themselves and stuff like that?
One of the big differences between Division I and Division III, in particular this year, is that Division I is using NOAAD scoring this fall, and Division III, I believe, is still using traditional scoring. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Correct.
So can you talk a little bit about any kind of discussion that's gone on among the D3 coaches, among the D3 players, about why you think that D3 has managed to stay strong and, you know, withstand these changes to the scoring system, and D1 is having a bit more of a challenge with that?
Well, the number one reason is because ESPN3 is not necessarily trying to shorten our matches to be able to televise them. So there's no direct demand for us to figure out a solution so that we can fit these matches into a shorter timeline. We don't have that stress. But, you know, I think that it's not to say that we wouldn't change things at D3. But typically what happens is things will be tested and kind of tried at the Division I level. And then I think we are in a position where we can kind of sit back and see how it goes. And if it's something that we really need to kind of adapt, then we can do that and discuss it, you know, at the meeting in December. But that's where a lot of stuff happens. So we're about 6 weeks away from discussing this more. When we get to Florida and we're at the convention and everybody's discussing how it's going and what they're going to do, I wouldn't say that we are not ever going to change, but it's definitely more of a traditional, slower move to dramatic changes at the Division III level than Division I. I will tell you this though. A lot of Division III schools are starting to figure out ways to get their players better competition. And I think Division I schools are also trying to find ways to deepen their tournaments and schedule to get the most out of their matches. So what I'm talking about is we went to the Purdue Invitational this fall, and there was another Division III team there. Boise State, they hosted an Invitational, and they had a couple of Division III schools there. This spring, we will be playing against Cleveland State. We've played against Toledo. We've played against George Mason. You know, we've played Division I schools consistently each year. And we practice, leading up to those tournaments, the Division I rules. So our players wouldn't really be blindsided by any of these things because we've kind of been exposed to it ourselves and have gotten to experience it a bit.
Interesting. And what's the feedback? I mean, when y'all go to a tournament hosted at a D1 facility, are the kids liking the NOAAD scoring, or do they have any strong feeling one way or the other?
That's a good question. I think it depends on the player. If you have this is what I experienced, like throughout that Purdue invite and for the 3 weeks leading up to their Purdue Invitational, every single practice match or scrimmage that we had, we did NOAAD scoring. The number one thing that I found was the returner's advantage. Pretty much if you're returning serve and it's 30-40, you've gone now from traditional scoring of having one break chance to having two break chances.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really, really big swing in the favor of the returner. I mean, essentially, from 30 all on, if you win that point and you get it to 30-40, you're going to get two chances to break serve. So it adds a lot of pressure onto the server.
Interesting.
So if you're not a good server...
That 30-all point becomes crucial.
Oh, it's huge. I mean, that's a really big point because if the server gets it, and let's say that they're a big server, like our number one player on our team, he's a 6'1", 6'2" lefty. UTR wise, he's a 12.9, which a 12.9 would put you at 5'6" in the lineup of a top 20 Division I program. So, I mean, this guy's good. I mean, he's a very, very good player. He's got a huge serve, big lefty serve. For him, I think it adds, you know, a little bit of pressure if he's sitting there at 30-40 and now he's facing two break points. Maybe mentally, somebody who's not used to, dropping a bomb and getting a free pointer or whatever may be able to handle that situation better because they're kind of used to being down and under fire on their serve. Or you could argue it the other way, that the guy with the big serve might have more of an advantage starting at like 30-all because they could more easily get a free point. But there's a lot of pressure on that serve, you know? I mean, so I think each kid's going to handle that situation different. But to me, right away, I was like, wow, 30-all is really important now. Because whoever gets that point only has to win one out of the next two, and they win the game.
Right. Right. And so how has that changed your coaching for these kids? I mean, are there specific drills that you do with them, specific scenarios you put them in during practice to prepare?
No doubt about it.
And are the coaches talking about that? Like, you know, what do we need to do differently from a coaching perspective to get our kids ready for that format?
We do it. Actually, to be honest with you, the challenge ladder, we have a singles ladder at the racket club that I run the high performance at. And we do no ad scoring. It's no ad, and it's a 10-point tiebreaker for the third set. And the kids are encouraged to play one challenge match or two a week. So we have in the junior ladder that we have at our club, we've got six kids that are already committed to going to Division I on that list. So they're getting practice each week on dealing with that. Now, as far as drills go, it's easy. I mean, just use your common sense. When we play sets in practice, and I do this with the juniors and with the team, we play sets where you start at 30-all every game. That gets them like immediately engaged, like, okay, every single point I play here is a big point. And so each kid, when they're practicing that, Lisa, they'll learn what patterns they can go with that'll give them the best chance of winning. Like, for example, I'm playing you and it's 30-all. Well, I love my slice out wide way more than I like any other serve on the deuce side. Okay, so if I've been hitting my slice out wide well...
I should tell you I'm a lefty. Does that change your strategy?
Oh, even better, because I'm righty. I'm going to go to your backhand now. Unless your backhand's better than your forehand.
It kind of is. It is.
Well, I think what I would do if I were playing you, and I slice it out wide to your backhand, and you're creeping over there and you're hitting that well, and I find myself in a 30-all point, I might take that slider and put it into your forehand body now. Thinking, all right, this is going to give me, what's going to give me the best chance of winning this big point? What are the highest percentages I can play here? Okay, well, I know my go-to play. That way, when they get into the match, they're like, okay, I've practiced this. I know what my go-to play is here. I know what I'm doing. And it's funny to me, you know, in basketball and in college, or college basketball, college baseball, college football, they have set plays. They run. I mean, there is so much homework done on the types of plays that are going to work against certain defenses, et cetera, et cetera. But yet in college, I bet you more than half of the coaches don't ever think about talking to players about what their go-to plays are, how to execute that go-to play. And that's the biggest difference between college and juniors is if you have a really good college coach who knows what they're doing, then they're going to be able to sit there in between every point and tell them what play to run, and so that takes the pressure off the kid versus in junior tennis that, you know, they're out there thinking on their own. I mean, they have right. to they have to do it themselves.
Right. But I have to tell you, and I'm going to say this to you because you are a high-performance junior coach as well, there are a lot of junior coaches out there that don't teach plays either. And it does a real disservice to these kids. And I've written about this a lot, you know, with my son's experiences. I mean, I was shocked to learn that he didn't have go-to plays until really about a year ago. And, you know, it's one of those places where I feel like a lot of junior coaches drop the ball.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't disagree with you. I think there's a lot of the industry that's just trying to, you know, get by and make a living. And then there's a part of the industry of people who are super into it, very obsessed. Like you've interviewed before, a great example is Matt Dectus.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know if I recruit any player that comes from his program, that I'm going to be able to rely on that kid. And they go over things like that, and they're super into, you know, the high performance end of things. You know, he'd be a great example of a guy that makes sure that those are the variables that his kids have control over and know what their strengths are.
Right. Well, it's just interesting to hear that you face that in college tennis as well. I mean, because to me, as an outsider looking in, I would think, of course, all college coaches have a playbook that they teach and that they, you know, coach during matches. But interesting that you're saying that's not necessarily the case.
Well, it just depends. I mean, you know, I was listening to one of your other podcasts, and you were talking to Ross about recruiting and the recruiting process and how a kid is going to. An important question for the student athlete to ask is, how many players are you planning on bringing in, and how many spots do you have available? And walk-ons. This was sort of like the subject of what you guys were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one thing was said that was like, whoa, I don't think that's right. You had asked a question that said, if a coach is doing their job and doing a great job recruiting, then if you're a person that goes in their freshman year and you're kind of like a lower rated or ranked or starred player and you're sitting on the bench for that first year, what's to say that you're going to get to play if the coach does their job and continues to recruit better players? And this is a big difference in coaching philosophy between one and another coach. Some coaches may just try to recruit the best talent possible and then assume that everything's going to be hunky-dory and they can roll the balls out there and that they're going to be good. Other coaches, they may take a stance and put their eggs in the player development basket, meaning players that stick it out in this program and go there for a year and maybe don't play, or 2 years, and then they get inserted in the lineup, and then it's their turn to play, immediately start to win, you know, immediately, because they've been prepared and they've been developed over time. So what's a coach's job? Is it to be a great recruiter, or is it to develop players? I think it's a mixture of both. But in the end, I think that developing your players is much more of your job, because it's the actual time you're spending on the court with them. Making sure that they're doing the right things in the off season, in the individual workouts that you're doing with them. Are you giving them the skill set that they didn't come in with? Are you teaching them the go-to plays that maybe they didn't learn when they were in juniors? You know, and that's a huge, huge difference between coaching styles. And I think a lot of people who have done their research or maybe seen what we've done at Case is, you know, we've taken ones and two-star, you know, quote-unquote players, and have cracked into the top eight in the country based on player development, not on recruiting.
Interesting. And I mean, that's a great point. And I do think it's a question that needs to get asked during the visits and during kind of the, you know, the communication between the player and the coach is, you know, what do you see your role as coach? Do you see your role as helping me continue to grow as a player or just, you know, making sure the team is winning? And or is there a crossover? You know, is it a mix of those things? And you're right. I think every coach takes a different approach to that. But, you know, depending on the player, they really need to choose the right program. Even though coaches leave and you know, there are changes each year, lots of changes each year in college tennis in terms of the coaches, I think a lot of times the culture of the team may stick around even if the coach leaves. So it's important to really have a good sense of what a particular program's approach is with development. But, I mean, I hear complaints all the time from parents whose children have committed to play at a certain college program. You know, the coach has said, you know, don't worry, we're going to fix this, we're going to fix that, you're going to grow as a player, and then it becomes all about winning and the development piece kind of goes out the window. So it's a buyer beware kind of situation.
Yeah, I think it's shaky to get an answer out of a coach, and that, you know, you were saying it's important to ask questions. I mean, you can ask the question all day long, but, I mean, you find me a coach who won't sit there in a meeting with you and say, oh, yeah, we're all about, you know, we want to make you better and we're going to work on this and that. But I think you got to just kind of look at the players they're bringing in and what they're doing. You take Ohio State, you know, I'm bringing them up because I know, you know, I was in that environment and I can speak on what's happening. A guy like Kevin Metka, who plays in the lineup at Ohio State, you know, he was a recruit that we wanted at Case. I mean, we were right there with him because he was an average 3-star recruit. And then all of a sudden, you know, his senior year, he grows a little bit, he matures a little bit, and he gets better, and Ohio State offers him to come there. Well, he doesn't play for his first year. He doesn't play for his second year. So it's been 2 years since the guy's basically played. And now all of a sudden, I mean, I could be wrong, but I think he clinched the semifinal of national indoors against Virginia or something like that last year. And he's playing at a level that, I mean, no one would have ever thought possible. And that's because, you know, that program puts a huge premium on developing their players. So if you ask him, you know, ask Ty, the coach at Ohio State, or you ask Coach X at another university, how important it is for them to develop players, you're probably going to get similar answers because the coach would be stupid to say, oh, no, we only want to recruit really good players. We're not really interested in player development. I mean, they're not going to say that. So really then it becomes more on you and your ability to do the correct research. What players have gone there and what have they done? Oh, wow, look at this. These guys are getting, you know, 4-star, 3-star recruits, yet they're top 5 in the country, Division I.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that's a great point. I mean, to look at, you know, where they started and where they've come in the first 2-3 years.
Yeah, and the statistics will be, you'll have other examples of like a guy that maybe didn't pan out or didn't work out. But really, I think a lot of that kind of then shifts over into the character recruitment versus the talent recruitment. And if you do a good job of recruiting the right character, somebody who really is into it and super driven to get better, and you have a program that's super into player development, well, then that's a win-win. Some other players may not want to be as serious about their process, and they may be just starting to gear up for getting ready for med school or getting ready for law school or getting a job, and they just want to still be able to continue on their tennis experience because they feel like they owe it to themselves. But deep down, it's not really that pressing to them that they really get better. and do something in that college experience. So knowing what type of kid you have, what's the personality of my child, you know, if a weekend goes by, Friday night you got football games, and Saturday they may have something going on with their friends or whatever. And I think if your kid goes through a Friday to Saturday to Sunday and isn't trying to find ways to schedule a practice match or get a practice in, then it might not be a good idea to throw them into a college program where they're real serious about, you know, court time and getting their players better. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's a great point. And, I mean, it's so funny because every time I talk to a college coach, I learn a different aspect of the process. And, you know, every time I think, oh, I've really got a handle on this now, and then I talk to somebody else and I, you know, I hear something new. And that's why having this show is so awesome. You know, and I'm so glad that you were willing to come on and share your perspective, because I think you have a unique approach to things in that you played at one level, you've coached at a different level, and, you know, you've been around it from so many different perspectives that you're able to kind of take the best of all those worlds and pull them together.
No, I totally agree. I always tell anyone who asks, everything I'm doing is just things I've learned from somewhere else. I mean, there's nothing truly original about the way that we work our program here at Case. It's just something you pick up there, or you pick up there, and then you kind of put your own twist on it, and you kind of make it work, you know, for the kid's sake. But yeah, I mean, I just think it was really interesting for me when I graduated from Ohio State, and it was July. It was the end of July, and I was enrolled to go into graduate school at Ohio State. And I, you know, I got an apartment and I signed a lease, and then all of a sudden the Citadel called and they said that they really needed an, you know, assistant coach, and that they have a GA position. And Ty knew the guy at Citadel, Toby, and they were friends, and he said, hey, do you have anyone? He said, well, look, I have a guy that's going to grad school now. And I went, to make a long story short, I went to my college advisor at Ohio State and I said, listen, I have this opportunity. This school, you know, it may not be ranked quite as high as Ohio State's sport management program, but it would be to get an MBA and have a concentration in sport management. So, you know, I really wanted to go into sport management. And he said, listen, how badly do you really want sport management? Do you really want to master this subject? Because that's what a master's is. Do you want to become a master of sport management? And I said, yeah, I'm so into it. Sports is everything to me. I think that when I'm watching sports on TV, I call it homework. When I'm listening to players speak in their post-game interviews, that's homework. I'm learning from what they're saying and what they're doing. And now I listen to more coaches speak because that's more applicable. And he said, well, listen, if you want to master something, you can master it wherever you want. It's more about the passion you have for the subject than it is, you know, where you're going. So anyway, I just think, like, tennis-wise, I've put so many hours and was teaching tennis even when I was 13 years old, tossing balls to little kids and, you know, the whole bit, that you've put so many hours in, you've done so much in this area, you basically have already made yourself kind of a master of that subject just based on the experience level you have put into it. And so with tennis in college, a lot of these kids are not going to go in the tennis industry. They're going to go in and do medical school or law school, or they're going to go to, you know, do co-ops, or they're just going to start working. And the number one thing I try to tell them is, look, you can use tennis to teach you how to become really, really, really good at something and to get yourself better and to get the most out of yourself. And through that process, you're going to be able to take that mastery of that skill and translate it into something else. Because typically their passion is going to be for medicine or engineering or business or English or art, whatever it is, if they have a true passion for that and they can take that same energy and passion for tennis and get themselves better and translate it, then it's a win-win. Then you've done your job and they can go off and become adults and do what they're doing. So, I kind of went off on a tangent there, but to make a long story short, all I've done is just taken everything I've learned from everyone else and just said, all right, let me store that, save it for when it's applicable, apply my passion and my energy, and hopefully the kids that are in the junior program or the kids that are in the college level get something out of it that's going to make their life different or better.
Right, right. And that's, there have been articles after articles published recently about, companies hiring athletes and tennis players in particular, and why tennis players are such great hires for these, Wall Street firms and other companies. And it's exactly what you're saying. It's the passion, it's the work ethic, it's the competitive spirit, all of those things combined make somebody an ideal candidate, at a profession outside of the sport. I mean, it's incredible what these kids learn through the process of tennis.
Mm-hmm. Independent thinking, responsibility, totally.
Yeah. Well, so put on your high-performance junior development hat for me for a minute. We're coming to the end of the hour, and I want to make sure we touch on the junior side of things, too. There's been, so much talk about what's wrong with American tennis and, that our kids are soft and our coaches are the problem, our system's the problem, the parents are the problem, video games are the problem. Can you talk about what you see with the kids you work with in your environment in terms of all of those different factors, their work ethic, their fitness level, the commitment level of the family, the coaching they're receiving, the academic pressure, all of that, and how you as a coach work with your kids to help them deal with all of those challenges?
Well, yeah, with the junior, high performance hat on, I've actually been very lucky to have been a part of these Team USA meetings. I'm not sure if you've heard about, when Patrick McEnroe was involved, he came and visited every section, and I sat in on the USTA Midwest section meeting, and I've been on the phone with the high performance guys down in Florida talking about one of the players that we have at the racquet club, who won the Midwest Close 14s and then won the Midwest Open 16s, and is showing a lot of incredible amount of talent. And Richard Ashby and Ken Kinnear and Jeff Russell and these guys are on the call. And to me personally, I told them, I'm like, you guys are under such fire. Everybody's so critical of every move that's being made. But just the simple fact that we're sitting here on the phone and they're interested in talking to me, the coach here in Cleveland, who's working with this player, I thought was a massive step in the right direction. And it falls in line with the whole Team USA concept. If people started working together more, it can never hurt. The more communication, the better. So you have to take a step back and look at this. If people are being that extremely critical of something, that's not a bad thing. A lot of people might say that stress or that anxiety is negative. I think the more people are talking about it and the more questions we're asking, that's probably better, not worse, because it means people are passionate and it means that they're trying to find solutions for how to make our kids better. So, from a vague standpoint, to answer your question, I think it's bad to look at it from a negative perspective. We're under fire, the American kids, whatever. We all get it. That's not a bad thing. It's good that we're trying to figure it out. Now, what we do with our kids, in the area here, is we literally just try to expose them to as much as we possibly can. Meaning, we only run group 2 days a week. so that the other couple of days, well, we run group 3 days a week. The other 4 days a week, we are strongly encouraging our players to have practice matches, go to another group, go to another clinic, go learn something and expose yourself to different things so that you can learn and learn and learn. And I think that happens a lot with outside of the U.S. is there's a lot of traveling around to different countries, especially in Europe, because it's easy to get around. There's a lot of ITF tournaments where they can go and they can play different types of players. And then there's a lot of level-based play where the kids are getting exposed to adults, adults are playing against juniors, and vice versa. That happens quite a bit in Europe. Whereas here, you know, we're only competing against the person that's our same sex and that same age. And I think that just really kind of hamstrings us. So we try to tell our kids, on Friday morning practice at 5:45, we invite all the 4-5 and 5-0 adults to play in the same exact clinic as the top-level juniors. And it's incredible what they learn, the different shots that they could hit, the different ways of thinking about the game and how to win. And you see this, like, 50-year-old guy who's doesn't seem like he should be better than that junior, but he's getting under his hair and he's frustrating him because he's not hitting the same ball that that kid's used to, right?
Right.
So the bottom line, you know, with this whole thing is exposure to different opportunities. Let them go down to Florida for a week and spend some time with the USTA people. And then they'll come back home and play a practice match against a girl, a boy, a man, a woman. Play different sorts of events so that you're learning from different experiences.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we've kind of been doing for the last year and a half or so with my son. You know, we're kind of late to that game, but, you know, it's just a factor of that's when we were exposed to that thought process, and it's made a huge difference. And I don't know. I mean, I'm so kind of over everybody blaming this group, that group, the other group, and really it's all of us needing to work together to create an environment that's conducive to producing high-achieving kids, whatever that means, whether it means they're playing on their high school team, whether it means they're playing on, you know, a junior team tennis team, whether it means they're playing high-level Division I tennis, whether it means they're turning pro, whatever it is, but having the environment there to support that high level of work and achievement for the kids that want it. And, you know, I do think we're moving in the right direction. There's still a lot of potholes on the road that need addressing, but I guess...
I wouldn't disagree, but I mean, the bottom line is people are talking about needing solutions, and whether, you know, they're blaming this or blaming that, at least generally we're trying to come up with a solution, right?
Yeah.
So I've noticed that it is moving in the right direction. You'll never hear me make any excuse at all about the whole entire process except for one factor. I think that it's much more possible for a kid to get involved in multiple sports in the United States than it is in other countries, meaning baseball, basketball, soccer, football, and lacrosse now, field hockey, tennis. I mean, you go to Europe or China, they're not that many venues for top athletes to go and find a way to progress. So the funny thing that we were doing in Indianapolis while we were at our meeting was the NFL draft combine. So while we were sitting there, we came up with this idea of having like 7- and 8-year-old combines where we just brought in a whole bunch of kids and tested them on like 10 skills, even if it was just sprinting or carrying a ball in the racket or whatever, and then kind of sifting through and saying, wow, these kids really have a natural talent or athletic ability. Let's find a way to get them into tennis 1 or 2 days a week through a quote unquote like combine. Mm-hmm. I thought it was like a great idea, you know, to reach these kids at a young age before they start getting exposed to all the other sports. And that was a solution that kind of came out of, you know, people asking questions.
I think you'd have to start it at age 4 nowadays. So, I mean,
yeah, you're probably right.
It's ridiculous how early these kids are specializing. And you know, I had Dr. James Andrews ago talking about, you know, the prevalence of adult injuries in children now. And, you know, so it's, anyway, it's crazy. We are down to the end of our hour, though. And so before we finish, I want to just ask you, is there anything you'd like to leave us with that I've neglected to ask you that you wanted to make sure to share?
Well, you and I were talking beforehand, you know, we were just kind of going over the topics that we would be discussing and things like that. And the biggest thing that I wanted to leave with as far as advice for parents in the recruiting process is that it's my number one thing, that recruiting, finding a place to play college tennis is just like a fingerprint. There is no way that you should be comparing yourself to others, because just because someone got offered this or that or got into this or that school doesn't necessarily mean that it's the same as your situation. And you just have to, you have to put your blinders on, ask all the right questions, and get the right guidance. People like Ross at Scholarship for Athletes are great resources to use, and they're going to help you through that process. But you got to worry about yourself, and don't compare your situation to anyone else. And I think that you'll do yourself a lot better justice just going through it and worrying about you. And you know just as well as I do, because, you know, you're on the tennis parent side, the rumors and the things that people love to talk about, and my daughter got this or my son got that, you don't really know. And you won't know. So it doesn't really do you any good to worry about it. Just worry about your own situation. Develop good relationships with your coach. Ask the right questions. Find the right fit for you, not because it was the right fit or something that happened for someone else.
Well, that makes total sense. I think that's great advice. So thank you so much, Todd, for being with us today. And to my listeners, thank you for tuning in. I hope you learned as much as I did from talking with Todd today. And I, you know, we're all in this together and all just trying to do the best we can by our kids and helping them become the best tennis players, but more importantly, the best humans that they can become. So, Todd, thanks again for being with us. Best of luck to your team this year, and I'll be keeping an eye on you guys, and hope to get to meet you in person sometime soon.
Yeah, that would be awesome. I really appreciate being on and talking tennis with somebody who's as passionate about it as I am. Really enjoyed the talk, and anything else I can do, definitely feel free to let me know. I'm all into the tennis industry, and I'm super into it, and I'm really happy to have the opportunity that I have. Maybe some other time I'll share with you the story and why I am so passionate about the game, but we would need another hour for that probably.
Well, you'll have to come back. No problem.
All right.
All right, great. Thanks, everyone. Have a great week, and we'll see you next week on Parenting Aces.